This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
For our last meeting of the 2020 legislative session, it goes fast in the aggregate, and some days it goes slow. So today it feels like it all went by pretty fast. So let's begin by establishing a quorum.
Senators Duhamel?
Aye.
Foster? Jensen?
Here.
Rush? Russell? Steinhauer?
Here.
Soholt?
Here.
Madam Chair, a quorum.
All right, we have a quorum to do our business and be coming in and out of committee today because we've got multiple bills in play. So we're going to get going on our agenda for today. If anyone wants to testify, be sure to sign in and please print legibly because that really helps Rena with her capturing of the minutes. She does a great job. We have pages that join us every 2 weeks. Come on up, introduce yourself, tell us where you're from, and share something that we might not know about you.
Good morning. I am Tiana Cheddar. I'm a junior from Doland, and my favorite animal is elephants.
Oh, have you seen an elephant? Yeah. All right. Okay, thank you for helping us out today. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Avery Weinheimer. I'm from Soli Buttes, and I'm a senior. And an interesting fact about me is that I have, 17 goats.
Wow, elephants and goats. That is very interesting. Thank you for helping us out today. Senators, we have before us minutes from our meeting of Monday, March 2nd. Thank you, Senator Jensen, for approval of those as a motion, and Senator Duhamel as a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. All right, we have approved those minutes. So today, with us not having any bills or resolutions to attend to, we are just very lucky to have with us our Secretary of the Department of Health, Kim Olsen-Reisden, and also our state epidemiologist, Dr. Joshua Clayton. And others may be testifying as well, but with everything that's going on with COVID-19 or the coronavirus, there are multiple strains of the coronavirus, so that's why I put it on as COVID-19 onto the agenda. We thought it might be really a great time for us to receive an update, because not even so much for us getting proper information, but for us to help as health committee members to dispel misinformation, because there is a fair amount of that going on. So I want to welcome our esteemed colleagues within the Department of Health, and we'll turn it over to you to introduce yourselves and to give us that update.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning and welcome.
Kim Olsen-Reisden with the Department of Health. With me is Dr. Joshua Clayton, our state epidemiologist. I'd also like to introduce one other person who's here with us today, and that is Bill Shellcraft. Bill is the head of our preparedness efforts within the Department of Health. And when we come and talk about some of the areas that we work in every single day, preparedness is one of those, and it's precisely for incidents like the coronavirus and the COVID-19 disease that we have that planning going on throughout the year. So I'm going to make the first disclaimer here, and that is the information that we're sharing with you is as of late yesterday. This is a rapidly changing event. The numbers change every single day, sometimes more than once in a day. And so thank you, Madam Chair, for the call out about really encouraging people to find credible sources of information. People can always come to the Department of Health website. We have the latest information that is verified from both international and national sources. And so that's just a really important component as we move forward. So feel free to use our website. We encourage people to do that. And we've got a lot of information out there already. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Clayton.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us today. My name is Josh Clayton, and I serve as the state epidemiologist. I'm going to begin with talking a little bit about what are coronaviruses. So coronaviruses are a family of viruses that does include the common cold, as well as other viruses, the other viruses that have emerged and been novel viruses, which include SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, and MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. Typical coronavirus causes mild to moderate symptoms, typically in the upper respiratory tract. Those symptoms include runny nose, headache, cough, sore throat, and a fever. On occasion, and we see this a little bit more with our novel viruses, such as the COVID-19, sometimes they do cause lower respiratory infections. So that can be things where we have pneumonia, bronchitis, or acute respiratory distress syndrome. Transmission occurs when a person breathes in the air of an infected person or spends time with a person in direct close contact, or potentially indirect through contact with infected items. That would be things like pens, light switches, and so on that are either objects or things in the environment. For the emergence of novel coronavirus, we have seen really kind of an unprecedented march of this virus. In December 31st, the WHO was first notified of a cluster of pneumonia of unexplained origin that occurred in Wuhan City in Hubei Province, China. Shortly after that time, Chinese officials notified the World Health Organization of identification of the virus causing the illnesses, and it was subsequently named 2019 novel coronavirus on January 9th. Later in the month, on January 30th, the World Health Organization first declared a public health emergency over this emerging virus. What we have seen as far as emergence into the United States, on January 17th, the United States began traveler screening for individuals specifically from Wuhan and Hubei Province, and that originated at three different airports. That subsequent screening has been extended to 11 airports and included all of individuals from Wuhan, from Hubei Province, where Wuhan is located, as well as mainland China. On January 21st, we had the first human case identified in the United States, and this was a resident of Washington State. On January 30th, we had our sixth case was identified, and it's notable because this was the first person-to-person transmission that occurred, and this was a case that was identified that lived in the same household as a confirmed case. This was identified in California. On January 31st, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services then declared the COVID-19 as a public health emergency. And on February 26th, so very recently, we had our first case of community transmission. So the case had no identified risk, so it had not traveled internationally, as well as had not been in known close contact to a person with COVID-19 infection. On February 29th, we have had our first death identified in Washington State, and as if you've been able to see some of the updates in the news, the number of deaths have continued to increase in Washington State. It is worthwhile noting that when we talk about COVID-19, that is the disease that is caused by the virus, and the virus itself is noted as SARS-CoV-2. So looking at the case counts that we know of and deaths and so on that have resulted from COVID infection, this information is current as of yesterday. And internationally, we have over 91,000 confirmed cases, the majority of them originating in China. But the percentage of those cases that are now occurring outside of China is increasing. We've had over 3,000 deaths in total, and again, most all of those have occurred in China at this point. In the United States, we have 108 laboratory confirmed cases, as well as six deaths that have been identified with this virus. And I'm happy to report that so far in South Dakota, we have zero confirmed cases and zero deaths in the state. So this is a map that was created by Johns Hopkins University that helps keep the general public, as well as a myriad of other health partners, updated in terms of the number of COVID-19 cases that are occurring internationally. The information is pulled from multiple different sources, including the World Health Organization, press releases that are issued by federal public health agencies such as the CDC, as well as states and other countries. For the international response, the World Health Organization represents the coordinating body, an agency for the global response. Their primary focus has been to limit person-to-person transmission, identify, isolate, and care for patients with COVID-19 infection, and communicate with the countries as well as other health partners. The focus for the initial response was to limit the spread of the virus by imposing travel restrictions, and the ongoing focus, again, is to limit that person-to-person or human-to-human transmission of the virus. Several of the different components to the World Health Organization's response include clinical management of patients, infection prevention and control, which is very important to prevent individuals like healthcare providers from becoming ill, surveillance for cases, deaths, and so on, so we can fully identify the impact of COVID-19 within our communities and countries, as well as being a very solid resource, as CDC is for us, on risk communication. For the U.S. response, we have been focusing on monitoring healthcare use, primarily identifying what individuals in our clinical facilities, hospitals and clinics, need in terms to of caring for patients. There has been a large number of guidance that has been developed by the CDC and has been made publicly available on their website, has been passed through to the state health department, and then subsequently passed through to our healthcare partners, including things related to infection control, hospital preparedness assessments, personal protective equipment, supply chain management, and clinical evaluation and management of patients that might be ill or showing up on the doorstep of these clinics and hospitals. The focus with identifying supply chain partners is to make sure that we have the appropriate PPE available when we are impacted by COVID-19 infections in the state. And the first thing that we need to do is focus on making sure we know what we have and where the sources are for that PPE. The CDC leads our coordinating body for public health agencies at the state level, and so they have been making sure that we have guidance that we need. We have multiple calls every week, if not daily, to make sure that we are able to communicate what's going on the ground for states that are not impacted to hear information and really to know what's going on with the spread of novel coronavirus and our focus on reducing that impact. We have also supported through CDC guidance, businesses, communities, colleges, with the guidance that has been coming out on COVID-19, as well as starting to educate our individuals in the community and families of what they can do to protect themselves using something called non-pharmaceutical interventions, which is a fancy way of just saying layered actions that individuals, families, and our individuals and organizations in the community can do to prevent the spread of infection.
So in South Dakota, to bring you up to speed on what we've been working on, we have had for now about a month an internal agency work group that brings in various perspectives that can help us work with our healthcare partners and other state agencies. So we've been meeting very regularly. We have different levels of groups meeting, and it includes agency leadership every single day. We've been, as Dr. Clayton mentioned, we've been talking with healthcare providers about various topics, especially as we've gotten guidance from the CDC, and we'll talk through a little bit more of that here in a minute. We do have some ongoing ways that we communicate with providers, and again, these are really effective when we don't have a crisis, and so we have ongoing communication through things like our South Dakota Health Alert Network, and so we deploy those resources in situations like this. They're very effective at getting messaging out. We do have the capability of doing COVID-19 tests at our state public health laboratory. last week. If we were here a week ago, I would not have been able to say that. So this is a rapidly developing aspect of the national response. And so the ability for states to have the testing capability is very, very important so that we really know what is happening and can control the spread as much as we can. So we're happy to be in that position right now. We also have a specific website, and again, that's part of our DOH website, but that's really where we're driving people for good, solid, credible information. The next thing I'm going to talk about is a little bit more about our action plan, so you can kind of get a sense of the things that we're working on and the things that we'll be continuing to work on. So we've got an action plan that has some specific areas. We use a modified incident command structure when we deploy groups like this. So if you're familiar with that structure at all, some of these things will be familiar to you. So information management, that is a huge aspect of any event like this, because there is a lot of information, and we want to make sure that we're getting good information out to people. So you can see a little bit of the activities there. We're having a webinar, as an example, tomorrow, a very wide-reaching webinar to bring people up to speed on what we know in various areas for healthcare providers. And then we will be doing some more specific webinars on an ongoing basis for folks that work in laboratories, folks that work in infection control, again, just as a way to get that information out there and understand the needs of providers across the state. Incident management would be, you know, the kinds of things where we're talking to hospitals about what kind of supplies do you have on hand, making sure that we have a good understanding of that so that if we have cases in particular geographic areas, we have a good sense of what is available and where we can potentially help. Surveillance is all around making sure we understand what's going on with people across the state, and so building the capacity to quickly investigate cases if, you know, probably not if, but when. Working with laboratories to ensure that they're doing testing as needed and, again, building up that lab test capacity. One thing we wanted to spend a little bit of time on, because it's going to be very, very important as communities encounter this disease, is the concept of community mitigation. And so what you heard Dr. Clayton say was the original response in the U.S. was to really try to contain its spread through quarantine, screening and quarantine of travelers. That we've now surpassed that as an effective strategy, and so we really have to be looking at how do we mitigate spread within the community, because we know the disease is spreading that way. So you're going to hear us talking about concepts, and you're going to hear from your constituents, folks that work in schools, folks that are, you know, employers are having to kind of consider some of these kinds of strategies if we see large impacts of this disease. So social distancing would be one aspect of community mitigation. That's just general, you know, stay away from people that are sick, which we would say during, you know, influenza season as well, but it just has, you know, a different meaning when we're talking about COVID-19. If you've been around somebody that's traveled to an area where there is known COVID-19 disease, you know, monitor yourself, be very aware of what these symptoms are, and be responsible about monitoring and using healthcare as needed. In terms of healthcare, you know, healthcare providers across the state are having to consider, you know, how do we help people screen and not necessarily come into contact with folks that are sick if they don't need to. So we do know that with this disease, a lot of people experience very mild symptoms. They don't necessarily, you know, rise to the level of needing hospitalization. How do you manage folks in that situation well and not lead people to get into contact with more people than necessary? There could be the need for potential targeted geographic or population-specific actions, depending on how this plays out. And that could lead to things like potential closures of places where large numbers of people congregate. That calls into question, you know, schools, workplaces, mass events. So those are the kinds of things that we're referring to when we talk about community mitigation, and those are the kinds of things that we're actively thinking about and working with our partners to plan in the event that we need them. So general protection, this is a good pitch, and this is just good general information that everybody on this committee certainly knows, but for anybody else, you know, protect yourself. Wash your hands often. Wash them more often, using soap and water whenever possible for at least 20 seconds. If you can't do that, use alcohol-based gel. Avoid touching your face your eyes, nose, mouth with unwashed hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. So these are common sense precautions that everybody can take. If you have cold-like symptoms, stay home from school, stay home from work. Don't expose other people. That's that social distancing concept again. Cover your nose and mouth, again, very common sense. And then self-monitor. This is the time to be vigilant. We don't know enough about the disease to rule things out, and so we need people to really be aware of that and call ahead to your doctor's office if you think you might need to be tested for COVID-19. We wanted to share with you a few frequently asked questions based on what we're hearing, you know, with folks calling the Department of Health and what you all might be hearing from people back in your districts. And I would just mention that there's a good list, and we have the link there on the CDC website that has lots and lots, so we're not going to go through that many. But again, what should people be doing now? You know, prevention. Prevent becoming sick. Those are just good things that we should be doing all the time. We really encourage families to think about what would you do in the event that you had to stay home for a couple of weeks for whatever reason. Dust off those plans and make sure that they can be implemented if necessary into the future. What are the symptoms and complications? We have already talked about those. So fever, cough, difficulty breathing, and all the way from mild to very severe. Should I be tested for COVID-19? That's been something that I think is going to continue to develop. As of this morning, if you were listening to the news, there's a lot of discussion around testing access and how that's going to play out. But as Dr. Clayton mentioned, we follow the guidelines from the CDC in terms of what we direct healthcare providers for submitting tests. So we will continue to follow that guidance. But we tell people if they call us today, talk to your provider. Your provider can help walk through the symptoms, and then they can help ferret out whether a person should be tested or recommended for testing. Use of face masks. You may have heard that there's kind of a run on the market on face masks, and that's a very real issue. So we wanted to make sure that folks here understand that face mask use is not recommended for individuals outside of being recommended by their doctor because they themselves are ill. So face masks that you can buy off the shelf are not going to be effective at preventing you from getting COVID-19 at this point. Please don't go out, hoard face masks for personal use unless your healthcare provider instructs you to do so. We really need that supply available for healthcare workers who will be coming into contact with sick individuals. Community spread, that's another term. We've talked about that a little bit, but that really means folks are becoming infected with the virus in an area who aren't sure how they got it. So this isn't a person who has traveled to an affected area, isn't living near or come into contact with somebody who has COVID-19. And so that's when we talk about community spread, that's really what that means. And we're at that point, and that is what makes this particularly hard to manage moving forward. Should I cancel my trip? That's been another question that a lot of people have had. And so we would encourage people to really look at the CDC website. They keep that updated with travel recommendations, and that changes. They review those actually every single day with what they know of the situation in other countries. And so that's what we're telling people to do. The last question was is also one that we've had here in South Dakota. And if you think about all the products that are made in China that we all as consumers maybe, you know, probably encounter on a pretty regular basis, should we have concerns about them? At this point, the answer to that is no. The virus is not expected to be able to survive on surfaces that would, you know, be part of a package that would be shipped, you know, from China to the U.S. Again, all these things are changing on a rapid basis. So this is as of right now what we have the understanding of. Dr. Clayton mentioned some of the guidance that we've pushed out that I think is going to be really important, and as well as I think there's, at last count, more than 80 pieces of guidance for different groups, and, you know, obviously in a lot of detail, depending on those groups, but healthcare providers, child cares in schools, businesses, employers, you know, we really appreciate the help of the CDC. They're doing a good job of helping different segments of our society be prepared. So we pushed these out, and they are available on our website as well. At this point, we wanted to just take a couple of minutes and help put this current situation with coronavirus into the context of influenza, because you're very aware that we come and talk to you about influenza every year, and we're still in our influenza season, and we thought this would be just a helpful contextual comparison, and so we'll have Dr. Clayton do that for us.
All right. So it's important to note that the cause for influenza is different than the virus that causes novel coronavirus or COVID-19 infection. The symptoms are very similar. So with influenza, you have fever, cough, body aches, and fatigue. The constitutional symptoms for COVID-19 infection are fever, cough, and shortness of breath. The incubation period for influenza is about 1 to 4 days. For coronavirus, it's about 2 to 14 days. So there's a little bit longer incubation period there, or the time from when a person is exposed to the time when they would expect to develop symptoms. Transmission for both of the viruses is from person to person, so an infected person to a susceptible person. Testing is widely available for influenza A and B. You can walk into any hospital, clinic, or even pharmacy and get tested for influenza. At this time, COVID-19 infection, or testing for COVID-19 infection is only available at the South Dakota Public Health Laboratory, but it is important to note that CDC and the Food and Drug Administration have been focusing on providing testing capabilities to a much wider community and getting that out to other laboratories, including university laboratories, as well as hospitals. Interventions, we do have known things that do help prevent illness and help prevent the severity of illness progressing to hospitalization and death. That includes vaccines and antivirals for influenza A and B. Unfortunately, there is nothing that has been shown to be proven and effective to decrease or prevent illness in individuals who developed COVID-19 infection. There are some antivirals that are currently being evaluated, but they're still in that very early phase. For those who have severe illness, the case fatality rate for influenza is about 0.1%. So we know that in an average year we have about 40 to 50 individuals in South Dakota who die from influenza. We know nationally that the estimate is, 20 to 60,000 as kind of an average. For novel coronavirus, our case fatality rate, it's about 2.0%. And that's information coming out of China. It's important to note just kind of where we're at in our flu season. So you can see from the graph, this is our current flu season. We have last week was our first downward tip in our curve of flu activity. And so we may have peaked, and I stress may. But we still have the rest of the flu season remaining. So individuals should get vaccinated against influenza, and that message has been one that we've mentioned from the start. Part of the reason is that individuals are, if they're preventing illness due to influenza, they're also preventing hospitalization, and that keeps some of those beds open at hospitals that might be needed for individuals who have severe COVID-19 infection. And then just in general, it does help with our evaluation of persons under investigation to make sure that the more individuals that we prevent from becoming ill in the first place, the more individuals that we will be working with clinicians to evaluate. This slide just talks about where we are with the flu season, where it compares to the past several flu years. We average, about 35 deaths in South Dakota and about 500 hospitalizations. So far for the flu season, we have seen a pretty strong showing of both influenza A and influenza A H1N1 and influenza B. We have seen 16 deaths, 384 hospitalizations, and more than 11,000 laboratory confirmed cases. And this is generally in the context of over, say, 30 million individuals becoming ill nationwide.
So, Madam Chair, we leave you with, again, some resource slides, and we will be making this slide deck available on our website, so anybody accessing the website will have these as well. And happy to take any questions. I know you're tight on time, so I apologize.
No, yeah. It's good, yeah. And thank you for that comprehensive overview. Questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Foster.
Thank you. I want to thank you in coming out and giving this information. I do have one question for clarification on the incubation time. Here it is listed from 2 to 14 days, and I had recently read that it was up to 24 days. And so I just wanted some clarification on that.
This is a rapidly evolving situation, and so with the best available information, we know that most individuals do become ill within that 2 to 14 days after they've been exposed to somebody who has been infected with COVID-19. The full extent of that range may extend beyond 14 days, but we have seen only documented a few cases of that occurring. So whether it's World Health Organization or CDC, the general guidance for incubation period is that 2 to 14 days, even though there might be some outliers that might be a little bit longer than that 14 days.
Senator Steinhauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the briefing and the information. And I also like the information about influenza. In fact, if you could just go back to the data, it looks like the confirmed cases is continuing to trend up over recent years, but the positive is the deaths and hospitalizations are going down. An awareness or any thoughts on what's going on there?
Well, each influenza season is unique unto itself. And so I think what we know about some of the testing and for laboratory confirmed cases, and this is a very important note, is that some of the tests that have been done in clinics and hospitals across the state, they've transitioned the tests that they're using to a newer test, and that newer test, based on our definitions for flu, are now counted as laboratory confirmed cases, where they had just been identified as in more of an aggregate way in our previous reports. Some of the differences that we do see, influenza B tends to be a little bit less severe of an infection in comparison to influenza A, and we have seen that predominate as the virus for the most part in South Dakota. This year. What we have seen this season is, in the last several weeks, we've transitioned to influenza A. So we are definitely not done in terms of the number of individuals who have been hospitalized and may die from flu yet this year.
Senator Duhamel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wondering, you used the when and the if. Are you presuming that this will get to South Dakota, or are we isolated enough that we can feel fairly safe in the middle of the country?
Do you have the Ouija board?
Yeah, Madam Chair. The CDC is really predicting that this is a matter of when, not if, communities see COVID-19, in large part because of the community spread aspect of this. So we are preparing as if we will see cases in South Dakota, and I would much rather be in the situation of spending time preparing and never seeing a case than not preparing and, seeing more cases than we need to, so.
Further committee questions? Well, I just wanted to thank our state epidemiologist, Dr. Clayton, and our Secretary Kim Olsen-Risden, Department of Health, really for your proactive considerations in relation to this and our people in South Dakota. And I think some of the take-home is not to panic and to get good information. And for those in the room, those listening online, really refer people to the website, because there is so much in social media and, you know, misinformation that can create panic. Mm-hmm. And that when it comes down to it, it's down to the same things that we always know. Try to eat well, do a little bit of exercising, wash your hands a lot, clean off surfaces that you touch frequently, stay away from people if you don't feel well. And so that's the most prevention that we can do, is really are things that are so much in your control as a person versus having to rely on something else. And that's, you know, our largest prevention factor. So thank you for coming and, you know, sharing where we're at. I know this is a great concern for our country and for the world. And when you start looking at what's happening on the quarantine and the incubation period and what that does to business, and, mm-hmm. you know, when we looked at, I know there were some satellite models of pollution in China. I'm sure a lot of people saw that. You know, a month ago, the amount of pollution from the factories that were going, and now almost virtually none that are detected by satellite, you know, that's just concerning for the world economy. Mm-hmm. But the only way out of it is to stay practical and to have good information. So to everyone here and listening, you know, stay as healthy as you can in other ways. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. All right, Senators, Senate Health and Human Services, we are at the conclusion of our work together. Is there anyone that had a summer study idea that they would like to bring forward? I know one of the things that we've been discussing is that we actually had, our committee has actually done some policy affirmation of a couple of areas in relationship to potential summer study. One is a continuation of the mental health work that has been going on for the last 2 years to really develop the regional concept of access for mental health issues. We also had an extensive policy hearing on the elderly and the long-term care continuum and endorsed that particular resolution. Those resolutions are going to be brought forward as summer studies, because we're starting to understand that as a legislature, we probably can't task. The funding is probably not even as much of the issue as just the personnel and the people and the depth of numbers to run 5 or 6 task forces over the summer. So at the end of the day, this probably will become executive board of the LRC, of the legislature, decision-making on prioritization, which is based on input from all of the legislators, because we can only take on so many things at a time. So that's where we see that kind of moving. So if between now and the end of session next week, someone has a burning desire of something, it wouldn't come on behalf of the committee then, but you certainly are welcome as individual legislators to provide a input to a summer study in relationship to health issue or any other issue that you may want to bring forward as an individual. That is always open to you as a legislator. So in our last meeting, I wanted to particular, on behalf of all of us, this is from the entire Health and Human Services Committee, particularly thank Michael Losevitz, who is actually new to the LRC, and he is with policy staff, and he's done just such a great job of working with many of us on health policy development, but also particularly with me as the chair, as we've looked at procedural things moving forward in relationship to bill drafting and amendment drafting and where we're at, and he's just done a great job for his first year within the staff of the LRC. So we just want to thank you. So let's say thank you to Michael. And then also to Rena Ortbahn, who manages all of our clerical and secretarial issues within the committee. She's been amazing. I've worked with Rena, this committee has, for quite a few years. She tried very hard to back away from working so much and was only going to help out with, what, retirement?
Legislative
procedures. She had put her foot down. She said, I'm only going to work with one committee this year. Well, we reeled her back in to help with Health and Human Services. We had a staffing need, and she's just so graciously continues to step up to the plate on behalf of supporting the legislators, and she's incredible to work with and tracks me down when I forget to sign off on things, and she's so sweet about it, instead of saying, what the heck, you didn't, like, do that again. And so, but also, just in, you know, when we say people do minutes and reports from committees, it seems like a simple thing, but to our secretarial support team that does that with accuracy and so quickly. I mean, those have to turn around so fast so we can have them read at the front of the Senate on the day of our committee meeting. It's just really incredible work, and we truly appreciate it. So let's thank Rena for her tireless work within the legislature. And then finally, to all of the senators on this committee, it's just been a pleasure to be the chair of this committee. You're a great team to work with. I want to thank you for your thoughtful, respectful deliberation, for coming prepared to this committee, and for helping to advance the public health policy issues of the state of South Dakota. It's just been great to work with all of you, and as a chair, I really appreciate it. You know, at times you can end up with, we've been all of our life when we chair different things, you can end up with teams of people around you that are not necessarily as great to work with, and it can create just a lot of additional anxiety and, you know, consternation about how is this all going to go, and that is certainly not the case with all of you. So thank you for being such a tremendous committee and for taking so seriously the health work of the citizens of our state. All right, and a special thank you to my vice chair, Senator Steinhauer, who stepped in time and again, and all of the rest of you that took the gavel just on a moment's notice. Really appreciated it. So is there any further business to bring before our Senate Health and Human Services Committee? All right, we have a motion to adjourn and a second by Senator Jensen. Moved by Senator Rush, seconded by Senator Jensen. Thank you again for a great year. We will now adjourn Senate Health and Human Services for the 2020 legislative session.